Hello, hello, and welcome to The Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the Rhodes Policing Unit before going into CID and Child Protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. Thankfully, I'm back to full health. Thank you for Richard for last week for hosting the show. I've got to say, it was could have done with some music. It was like a game show, really. It was very good. We were this week going to have a look at some funny police stories just to lighten the mood, but alas, that's not to be. Recently, the HMIC have issued a report entitled The Inspection of Vetting Misconduct and Misogyny in the Police Service. It makes very grim reading, and I think I probably speak for all three of us that we're quite sad, angry and frustrated, really. And perhaps it's just important to set out that, you know, we're not three retired cops here ready to bash the police service. We feel sad, you know, the overwhelming majority of police officers who have high moral standards and are just doing their best in the current adversities are going to get tarred with this brush of the minority. I think we're angry that this situation has been going on for years now, and we are frustrated that yet again the police seem to have scored another home goal and provide further ammunition if it were needed to the detractors of the police. So just looking at the report, anyway, it's 163 pages in length, 43 recommendations over five areas to improve. Just a bit of context and background to the report, really. The HMIC randomly pulled 725 vetting files, and of those, and in their words, they say 131 decisions were questionable at best. All these cases, forces had overlooked, downplayed matters, and cleared without rational explanation. Pretty grim. They did focus groups and interviews. They did an online survey. 11,000 police officers responded and staff, which is the largest response they've had to any survey. It was alarming that the number of female officers reporting sexual harassment and assault, and in many cases, the perpetrators have been reported previously for similar behaviour. They looked at the complaint and misconduct hearings. It was 264. Almost one in five. Again, in their words, they were unimpressed by the force's decision-making. And perhaps just to finish off the introduction, was the last paragraph from the opening report's summary. And it said that at the moment, it's too easy for the wrong people both to join and to stay in the police. Too many recent events prove this. If public confidence in the police is to be improved, chief constables, amongst others, need to be less complacent. Standards need to be consistent and higher.
It's not the report that's doing the it's a few bad apples stuff, but it's not the report that's doing it's a whole barrel load of bad apples stuff. It's the report that's saying the culture that you have in policing around vetting is too lax, around misconduct is too lax, and around misogyny is too lax. You're letting too much stuff go, and they have example after example after example of decisions that are clearly questionable, where an officer has ended up keeping the job, perhaps getting a 12-month written warning or a reflexive practice or something like that. And objectively, when you look at the facts, when you look at the history, that person should have been drummed out, and they weren't. And when you look at the vetting, again, example after example where the vetting hasn't been strong, in fact, has been permissive. It's been turning a blind eye to obvious things, not checking up on obvious things. My brother's an organised crime group member, but I hardly ever see him. Mate, you live with your brother. And we never check that up. That's just unforgivably lax. That's where standards have massively slipped. I remember when I joined the police service, I was living in Bury. A sergeant from Bury Police Station came round to my home address, met me and my wife, looked at who I was, how I was living. You know, it was that sort of intrusive and thorough vetting to make sure that there was nothing in my background, in my circumstances, that would mean I was unfit, unsuitable to become a police officer. That's gone. Clearly now, when something comes up that could be a problem, some forces are looking at ways to make that not a problem and get that candidate in. It's got to be wrong.
For me, it is tough reading. It's very easy to become immediately defensive about it. But a couple of things for me, it's not just a whitewash and it's not a superficial examination. This is quite forensic. And I don't think it's any coincidence that Mr. Cook's gone into the inspectorate very recently. And this report comes out because he is very thorough. And I can see Mr. Cook being his own person. The other thing that jumps out at me, it's not the IOPC doing this. It's not a group of people wanting to bash the cops. It is our own organisation, effectively. It's our own inspectorate machine. And it's needed in many ways because people need oversight. People need governance. The police need that governance. People need to be assured that in the darkest, most vulnerable hour, that the police are going to send the right person to come and look after you. Unfortunately, this smacks to me that people wanted to join the police not for the correct reasons or not for the reasons that I joined, where they would want a bit of, people joining because they want a bit of power. They want the badge. We've all known the people who, you know, have a bit of an argy-bargy on a Friday night. And as Finn, we used to get a phone call every few months to say that some student officers dropped the warrant card on somebody when there's been a fight and tried to arrest. Just inappropriate. Look who I am. I'm the big man. Woman, and we haven't been able to root those people out. So I welcome the report. And I've said it before, we need to turn over every stone. We cannot start healing. We cannot start afresh without turning over these stones, examining them and saying, right, what are we going to do? How are we going to move forward? And give us some recommendations. Now, this report gives many recommendations. I think it's 43, is it? Mm. Recommendations. Let's look at them. Let's not brush them under the carpet. But let's not be defensive.
It doesn't apply to me, I think. Never had any complaint like that in my service. I never did anything like that in my service around the misogyny and the misconduct stuff. The sort of examples that are brought up in the... And the only occasion when I was a supervisor that a misconduct came across my desk and I had to refer it on, that officer's now in prison. We talked before we came up to do the podcast about auditing to the bottom line. I used to be an accountant, used to do audits, and you'd have this thing, auditing to the bottom line, where you'd... This is the profit we want to show for the year for this company. So let's work all the figures towards producing this amount of profit for the year. And it feels, on some of the examples they've been given on misconduct hearings, but also on the vetting, that the decision's already been made that this person's going to get in or this person's not going to be leaving the police service, almost no matter what. We're going to engineer this towards a lower level of sanction. So they're going to get in the job after an appeal, or they're going to retain their job on a 12-month written warning or a final written warning or whatever. It doesn't seem to be that, you know, let the chips fall where they will kind of thing about it. If somebody's not right and they're shown that they're not right, don't let them in or get them out.
It's due diligence, isn't it? And it would be very easy to make a connection now at targets and say, well, we have to have these magical 20,000 police officers on the streets, etc. I think this has been deep-rooted there in a small minority for quite a while. There was an officer jailed for sex attacks in 2011 in Northumbria. What can we say from that as a starting point? What was done? What red lights flashed at that point, which allowed some change? What investigation was done by the inspectorate at that point? Because this came around, this report, from the Sarah Everard murder and the impact that had on the confidence in the police. Just if there's one, five, if there's 10 people slipping through that net, everyone's tarnished with it. Before I retired, I ended up declaring myself as a police officer at the scene of something to try and calm a situation down. And the quip back was, well, Sarah Everard was killed by an off-duty police officer. So it came straight back at us. And that's the badge I was wearing at the time. And one of us had done that. So we all feel it, don't we? It's not just a recent thing. Has it been exacerbated recently because of the drive to get 20,000 people through? Yes, probably, because a lot more vetting has come through.
And there's been a pressure to recruit people, hasn't there?
There has, yeah. So you've got to get more and more people. And the pressure's on vetting services and stuff. But it's more of a, tell us a reason why we're not letting this person in because we need this person to come in, rather than having a really good objective test done on the vetting, even on transferees, because the report goes into transferees and says that people who are transferring, who's got a big list of misconduct.
Well, Wade Cousins was a classic example of that, wasn't it? I think it was ex-CNC, wasn't he? And under investigation for various things.
It only takes a handful. And quite rightly, the confidence in the police is knocked. Because I don't have any children. But if I had, say, a teenage daughter who had been attacked, I'd want to know that the cops that's going round isn't trying to get the phone number off them, isn't trying to meet them and trying to use their position as a police officer to sleep with them.
There's a permissiveness. I know certainly that there are people bounced between divisions with allegations of sexual harassment, misogyny, sexual misconduct that never amount to a criminal sanction, but should amount to a discipline sanction. And the sanction seems to be you're up and moved somewhere else. And some of the nicknames that are attached to them, they're known within the organisation for this sort of behaviour. And it's never properly challenged. It's never bottomed. Nobody's ever saying to them, this behaviour is not compatible with being a police officer. You cannot do this. Your job is definitely at risk. Doesn't happen. Happens with some, but there's this, oh, they're a good cop. You know, they're good at this, they're good at that. We'll just transfer them somewhere else, give them a talking to, and it won't happen. And then it happens again.
It's the overhang of the boys' club, isn't it, from, what, the 70s and 80s, about the treatment of female police officers. I'm going back quite a while. I'm not saying that occurs now. And I think it's an overhang of some people have that impression when they join. They think themselves are going to be a bit of a jack the lion. Oh, it's only banter, in it.
We have to stress, don't we? Because we are talking about the contents of this report, that it is the very small minority of officers.
I'll come back to it. Maybe the bad apples thing, but those bad apples are in a culture that allows them not to prosper, then at least to bounce from place to place without anything significant or meaningful ever happening to them.
One of my frustrations, and it highlighted it to me the other day, I was out shopping and I bumped into a few ex-colleagues at police stations next door to the supermarket. You know, I've been retired, what, 8 months now? I said, oh, you know, how are things? And they went, oh, it's just the same. Nothing's changed. And that is the tagline of the police service. It's so slow to change and implement change and recognise that change is needed.
All too often, we do knee-jerk into some reactionary stuff, and it's very political sometimes when we knee-jerk and it becomes the flavour of the month. What we're talking about today is cultural, isn't it?
We can't blame austerity on lack of moral judgment, can we?
No, but it's standards of not just recruiting and vetting. And I'll say it again, and I think you bang this drum, Richard, as well. It's effective supervision, isn't it? That first and second line managers are the most important people in the job. Sergeants are the most important people in the job because you get your bearings, you get your standardisation, don't you, from your sergeant. And they're like dad, aren't they, for the first 6 months? You get told what's right and what's wrong. And
there's the army, you know, they scream out, I'm your mother and I'm your father. We probably use a bit more colourful language than that, but that was essentially
As a sergeant, you can set a culture of stuff that isn't tolerated and you don't behave that way either. And you set that example. On the vetting, that's an organisational thing.
But if you had effective supervision and someone did get through the vetting process, they were showing the true colours, should we say. I'd like to think with the interactions you had as a first-line supervisor, some alarm bells might start ringing. By that point, it's a little bit too late, but we can start thinking, actually, we might need to redo this.
Certainly one of the things in the vetting report, which I found interesting, was we're letting people in that had some risk about them. And the report was saying that risk could perhaps have been managed, but you didn't even put a risk management plan in place for them. You just brought them in. It's just lax.
It's pass or fail. It's red or green. It's not grey. It's not a pass with some areas for development, which we're going to help you with. Well, for me, it's such an important job. To all the cops out there who go out every day, do everything they possibly can. They come home late, they don't see their own families, et cetera, et cetera. They wait all hours God sends in all sorts of weather. I take my hat off to you, I really do. And every single one of them would want the bad apples rooted out or not even join it.
No, nobody hates a bad cop more than a good cop. I mean, I don't want to go back to remember when days. We're retired now and maybe people listening to this, well, what the hell do you know now? You're just bitter and twisted. Sure, you were not bitter and twisted. We loved our careers. And certainly when I joined and when you two joined, you know, there was bad things going on. It wasn't a better era or a worse era. But I do remember the process of getting in the police finished with a final interview with a superintendent and an inspector. And it was just, you kind of got the job, but they were just there just to keep an eye on the process and make sure that the process had produced the right person and they were there to rubber stamp it. And it was still possible to fail that interview. I don't know if that still happens.
I don't know if it still happens. I went through this long, long process to get into the police service. I remember that final interview. It was, any questions, Mr. Horton? Yeah, this has been about a 14-month process. When will I get a decision? Well, if you go outside and wait, it'll be about 10 minutes. And that was a proper moment, if you will.
Yes. yeah, your whole life's been leading to this moment.
Pretty much, yes. But I was vetted properly, I think, and there was nothing in my background or my family associations that would have caused concern.
There were considerable hurdles to get over, weren't they, in that 14-month process? It wasn't easy.
I remember having my own visit, even for the specials, and it was my section officer, which is the sergeant equivalent now, special sergeant equivalent now, coming around. And I remember it because I was nervous as hell. I mean, Mum and Dad were nervous as hell as well, because this was a big deal. And I felt like, actually, I'm going through the processes here, which if I get to the other side, I'll actually be proud to have earned it. I don't think it's earned these days, is it? I get a feeling you can have a bit of creative writing and then you can know how to speak in front of an assessment centre and know where things are going. You can be taught, can't you, to pass assessment centres?
Well, I had somebody close to me. In fact, it was my wife, so you can't get much closer than that. And she used to be an assessor for applicants and she had a list. They got a point for certain words that they used. And if they didn't use those certain words, they wouldn't get a point and potentially fail their interview. Not because they were potentially a bad police officer, but they used the wrong language. And I think, you know, the process to become a police officer has been watered down and skewed over the years. And like everything else we're saying now, do we need to get back to basics?
Could it be investment as well in the process? And is it a College of Policing centralised, one size shoe fits all approach?
The College of Policing are being asked to revisit the authorised professional practice in relation to vetting. I think on the basis that what's there doesn't properly reflect what HMIC, FRS think should be a proper framework for vetting. So perhaps if the framework allows this sort of slip and slide and people getting through that shouldn't necessarily get through and not making thorough checks on their background and checking their employment history is what they say it is. Their family associations are what they say they are. Their criminal or non-criminal history is what they say it is. And that's clearly in the examples that they've shown in here, in this report, that's not been done, not been done properly.
Well, we used the example earlier, didn't we, where we were talking, you in custody and you were about to release somebody on bail, custody sergeant would make you physically check the address, A, to make sure they lived there and that it was a suitable address. Now you can say, yeah, I live on the moon and right, that's fine. Mm-hmm. See you in 28 days.
It's that slip and slide and lack of professionalism, lack of thoroughness. I guess, used to be something like vetting would be thorough and you could rely on it being thorough and police investigations would be thorough and you could rely on them being thorough. And now it's just all a bit slippy and slidey and nothing's really set in stone. I don't like it. I really don't like it. There should be mandatory re-vetting. There is supposed to be mandatory re-vetting. I was in the position of going into CID early in my career and then doing 20 years in CID, and never once did a vetting form cross my path. Then I was promoted and I got vetted again. And then after about 5 years in post, I got re-vetted. Now, that's fine, but there seems to be this big gap mid-service where I wasn't vetted at all. I was just going along doing high-tech crime and murder investigation team and all sorts of fancy stuff. No vetting at all crossed my path.
And you can be married, you could be divorced. A lot of things can happen to in the first 10 years of your police service, isn't it? Or just 10 years of adult life when it gets started. You know, do we have the regular vetting for every single constable? But then again, how much does that cost? How many people does that require? How big does your vetting department need to be? As big as it needs to be.
Yes, what's the risk that you carry as with police officers, the repository of the ability to lawfully use up to and including deadly force on members of the public in certain circumstances at the top end. Yeah. That's what those people are in society. You could deprive people of their liberty, cuff them up, fight them, investigate them, do intrusive things around their personal information and their life, you know, with the right authorities. That's what you're trusting people with. And so there should be a really high bar, really good vetting to make sure you've got the right people in, because the powers that we have are right top end of what society allows.
And public confidence needs to see that. And we need to point to that high bar, wave a big flag at the public and say, look how high our bar is. So when someone does slip through the net or somebody does end up doing something which brings a light onto the police service, we can say, oh, come in and investigate us, come in and examine us again, and we'll learn from it and be, you know, but that's our bar. Look how much we invest.
There's nothing worse, is there, damage to public confidence when they, the public, see somebody getting away with something, either it be a police officer, we've seen it in the House of Commons or Houses of Parliament with various incidents that have happened. And there's just this feeling of one rule for them and another rule for the rest of us. And that just breaks confidence down.
That's such a good point, Dave. That it is that the one rule for them, one rule for us. I'd lose my job if I did that. If I went, you know, sort of sexually assaulting female members of my company, or I was making unwelcome sexual advances towards them, I would lose my job. But this cop's been given a 24-month or a 12-month written warning. What's all that about? They make the point that, you know, during the recruitment process, during the initial process, you can reg 13 people, as it's known, just dispense with them during the probation. And I think there's a feeling that perhaps wasn't used enough. People were kept on in the hope that they'd somehow be okay without...
Do you think that's a monetary thing in that, well, we've invested, you know, let's just say you've got somebody that 2 years shy, 2 months shy of their 2 years, clearly they're not suitable. Well, you know what, we've invested a lot of money in this person.
It's a significant investment. You put a tutor constable into them, you put all the training school stuff into them, you put the uniform...
Looking wages and everything, yes. You know, that's a total price. But I'm just wondering, whatever the figure is, it's considerable, it must be. And whether the force thinks, you know, we don't want to cut our losses here, we've invested too much money.
Maybe we, what they call the sunk cost fallacy. I spent so much into doing it, I've got to carry on spending money on it. And in fact, you've spent the money, you're never going to get it back. They're not ever going to be an acceptable police officer. Cut your losses.
Yeah, but like you said, Dave, and it's a very good point, that are we just keeping older people? Because we haven't got enough people to start with resignations, non-retirement, but resignations at an all-time high from the police. And are people looking at numbers on a sheet of paper and saying, well, if we get rid of X and Y, we're going to have even less cops on the street? So are we scraping that barrel?
You know, does it come down to reputational damage as well? And like you say, in the long term, by keeping somebody on is going to be worse than admitting that you've got a problem. Forces don't want to look bad, and there seems to be this culture. My experience is only my experience that, you know, supervisors and SMT, whatever, you know, don't go to them with a problem. They don't want to know about problems.
Yeah, and whether those supervisors get support as well from the professional standards department.
Well, their supervisors will go, well, don't give me this problem.
Well, exactly. You know, and it's
where
matter
does
of,
it stop?
I have an issue here, but we're all too busy to deal with these issues. We're chasing these jobs, and such a body's got 35 active investigations. We are too busy to deal with stuff, and but it's a cultural, and it's more of a slow burn, isn't it? Cultural. Going to that grade one job tonight is now here. Oh, that's the issue.
I do think, though, that the organisation, and when I say that, as a whole, has been slow to recognise that they have a problem.
I think if you look at the resourcing of professional standards departments, that has to be more of a priority, that there are sufficient to expeditiously investigate misconduct complaints and the like that come across their path. And that must happen. I know when I've been involved with referring stuff to professional standards, I've known them to properly respect whistleblowing stuff, in my experience. I've known them to effectively investigate complaints. But there aren't many of them in most forces. They're not a well-resourced department necessarily. And what this report points out, I think, also is that there perhaps needs to be more of them, and there needs to be that fierce independence in professional standards departments, that they're going to go and they're going to make the recommendations and they're going to put everything down on paper. It ain't written down, it didn't happen. And then if those above in the decision-making decide to go against, they're going to need to document their reasons why. And that's another part of this report. Often they could find no rationale for the decisions that have been made to retain officers that were subject to misconduct or no rationale for a decision was made to recruit an officer that had red flags on them.
I mean, we have to do it, don't we, now, with the IMD, the information management document on a court file now. You have to address all your lines of inquiry, even the ones that you haven't pursued, but you have to say why you haven't pursued them and give the reasons why.
I get a feeling some of these costs will be offset because you let, by not having a robust vetting service, which costs money, you let people in and then you're just going to spend 20 years investigating them every other year. So there's a cost of that. So spend the money upstream.
I think it's nasty tasting medicine, isn't it? No one's willing to swallow. Well, let's look at some of the recommendations that the report have put on. So updating minimum standards for pre-employment checks, better processes for assessing, analysing and managing risk, improved quality and consistency of vetting, extend the scope of law relating to police complaints, strengthen guidance for forces in respect of vetting. It's a surprise to me that there isn't a standard policy across the forces, understanding what constitutes misogyny. Scratching my head at that one, you know what's right and what's wrong, surely. Improve the way police collect corruption-related intel and improve the way police assess and investigate misconduct. They're all basic things, aren't they?
They're all saying this is stuff you should already be doing, and for whatever reason, you ain't doing it.
The public would look at that and go, kind of thought as a minimum standard, you'd be doing this. Why is the vetting standard of one force different than another? And it takes us back to the appropriateness of 43 forces and whether that needs to be drilled down a little bit. These are the things that the College of Policing should be worried about and setting standards for, is cultural stuff, not whether the smell of cannabis is suitable for a stop search. Ridiculous. Where the College of Policing been in all this?
They've been putting forward guidelines that aren't up to snuff, bluntly. What they've got, clearly, when you measure it up against this this report, what they've recommended either isn't being done, is being ignored, is being slid, or wasn't ever really up to snuff in the first place. I don't think it comes down one way or the other, but it does suggest that the College of Police revisit their guidelines in the recruitment and misconduct processes.
So what's the enforcement arm of all this now? How are we going to get that centralised vetting standard, for example? Something's going to have to come out saying you must. Not. It would be awfully nice if you could. We have to have consistency. Because you join one force, transfer to another.
There's a place there for the inspectors again. If it's a standard that we're meant to be held to of how we deal with our recruitment and our misconduct and misogyny within policing, and they make the point if it's misogyny, it's probably racism and homophobia as well that's going on. There's no reason why it should just be misogyny and the rest isn't happening. But you're inspected as to there is this fit-for-purpose College of Policing, authorised professional practice that covers these areas, and are you complying with that in an acceptable way?
Well, I mean, the report very firmly puts the responsibilities at the chief constable's door, isn't it? God forbid they'll have to talk to each other, and even more so, have to agree with each other. It's going to be an interesting watch, that.
Was it not a retiring, I might get this wrong, a retiring chair of ACPO, as it was then, who said, if you let people in who've got criminal convictions through the vetting process, you're just going to completely undermine public trust and confidence and the authority to carry on? And again, what did we do?
Although people will undoubtedly have moved on to another post by now that have been involved in the decision-making, where this report's gone through those decisions that they made and found them, you know, by a panel of inspectors and also subject matter professionals, that was wrong. So where's the consequence of learning for those decision-making officers or HR professionals that have got it so wrong? Be at least some retraining or a hard conversation.
Yeah.
It needs to say, right, the person who's making those decisions need to be this or trained to this level or make this judgment. They need to bring themselves to...
And properly accountable for the decisions that they've made.
Without wanting to single out the police, although this is a podcast about the police, so we can't help ourselves, but do we think just standards in general across the board in society is slipping on? As I mentioned, the Houses of Parliament earlier and...
Oh, for sure. Since Peter Mandelson's the first example I can think of, the modern minister, Mr. Teflon. Nothing stuck to him. He'd resigned from government and, damn it, in 6 or 7 months he's back in government again. And that's happening. I mean, now they're not even waiting 2 weeks before they bring them back to government. Yeah, so those standards there that, you know, John Perfumo went out of public, resigned, and went off and did his public works and tried to do good works for the rest of his life out of the sight of the glare of the publicity. That would never happen now.
The last politician I can remember that resigned as head of department was Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary. And if I'm right, she hadn't been told all the information and then gave a statement in the House, which was incorrect. You could argue, well, that wasn't really her fault. Well, she resigned all the same, because at the end of the day, it's her responsibility in her department. Are chief constables going to resign?
No, that's not going to happen, is it?
It's not necessarily what they're guilty of doing. It's what did the organisation do with that information once they became aware? And if they haven't acted on it, then, well, they're complicit, as far as I'm concerned.
And have they done due diligence to expose that information? You know, is it easily discoverable in a tight regime, you know, in a process?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, when I used to investigate fatal accidents, I had two terms of reference that I started with. The deceased driver or rider was A, were they there to be seen? And B, if they were there to be the scene, should the other driver have seen them? And those were the two points of reference. And it was quite simple. And you could use that analogy into corruption and misogyny and bad practices and misconduct. You know, should the force have known that this was going on? And in a lot of cases, I suspect, yes, they should have known.
And is there a desire to be as thorough, or is there a desire to do the bare minimum? What's required of me during this process? Minimum standard. Right, we'll do that. And I think over the last 12 years, we've got very comfortable of being at the bronze level of service in many ways, because, you know, we had gold standards and then we needed to move that to, and we got to bronze very quickly. So what's the minimum we have to do right now to pass scrutiny,
and I think it goes back as well to this culture of, you know, well, we've said it before, mistakes in the police are seen as a bad thing, and to admit that there is a problem officer in a particular force is an admission of damage to the reputation of that force, I suppose.
Yeah, and there'll be some that say, well, why is it always the police? It was the medical profession destroyed when Harold Chipman killed all these victims? Does that tarnish every single nurse, every single doctor, etc.? And what happens if it's a lawyer or an architect and all the rest of it? They don't equate. You join knowing what the job is. The responsibility of a warranted constable puts us on that higher pedestal, one, to enforce the law, take people's liberty, but also that when we get it wrong, we're gonna fall farther. There's a feeling I find sometimes on social media where people always feel that it's always the cop being attacked. But yes, that's what comes with the territory.
I think the difference between Shipman and sort of various baby harming or murdering nurses and police officers and the police service, nobody in the British Medical Association or the National College of Nursing and Midwifery is saying it's kind of okay to kill the occasional patient and maim the occasional baby. And then just kind of ignoring as well, saying, oh, you killed a patient, 12-month written warning. And we're having what should be never events, serial misconduct, recruiting people that should never have been recruited in the first place because we're not making proper checks. And as a professional body and the bodies that are around us, we can be seen, I think, as more permissive of that because we've allowed it to become our culture and our process. And that's the difference for me between those.
Well, it's the saying, isn't it? You know, you hope for the best and plan for the worst. Well, I think the cops have been hoping for the best for years and never planned for the worst.
This report should generate proper action, and it should be looked at, I think, retrospectively. There will be professional standards departments who know who their serial offenders are, who know who the people they've had to bounce from division to division to try and keep them, you know, get them out of the shit, as it's put in blunt in the job. They know who those people are, and they would suspect, I think, that if they had a proper look at them and properly put together a series of allegations against them and the evidence that they had on those allegations, that those people should be a target for investigation because they haven't stopped.
Yeah, I think they should be investigated. I think we've got to draw a line and not swing the pendulum too far the other way in tarring people through rumour and conjecture and people being like not properly investigated, but there's always been that rumour about, well, investigate it then. Exonerate them or prove it. So the rumour, and they go for a job in a specialist department, the rumour that the detective super hears about this rumour about, you know, Richard Horton, and go, well, he's not coming on my department. So even the by not investigating the officer, he's harming the harming the officer as well. So you've got to be really careful about not going down the witch hunt and drumhead thing.
I absolutely agree. And if you have somebody that had one incident 6 or 7 years ago, and they appear, you know, they've had the sanction, whether it was right or wrong, they appear to have kept their head down and learned from it. But we know there are people in every constabulary that have serial complaints made against them, both by members of the public and by fellow officers or civilian staff, and they limp along from resolution to resolution that never just quite manages for them to be not in the job anymore. That needs to change.
Mm. Well, it's going to be an interesting 12 months ahead. Certainly the report pulls no punches, and interestingly, we discussed it, didn't we? Yeah, Andy Cook has filled that report full of evidence, indisputable evidence. And again, we just want to stress that the vast majority of police officers are hardworking, have moral high standards, and they must be really feeling it at the moment for these few idiots that are in the police force that are just utter disgrace.
Yeah, so let's wash the wound. That's the only way we can do it.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time, on the next podcast, take care.